This is a special pleasure. This is a series about the New York intellectuals. And if you read about the New York intellectuals, I think in most of the books that I know, almost all, Milton Himmelfarb's name does not appear. So I'm hoping that this is one of the ways in which this tremendous, it's more than an oversight, will be revised. This is one of the most important figures in the group. I also have to say it's a little intimidating to be here in the presence of Martha Himmelfarb, his daughter, and members of his family, who can certainly speak about him in some ways much more deeply. But I hope that they will not find that I am wanting or lacking in my enthusiasm for this subject, because nothing could be further from the truth. Anyway, my first impression of Milton Himmelfarb, the man behind the articles, dates from the early 1970s when I was teaching at McGill, and I dropped by the office of one of my colleagues, Jerry Blitzstein, who was then a young but already masterful scholar of Talmudic literature. Jerry was on the phone with Milton Himmelfarb, who had called him from New York to check out a detail for an article that he was working on. And I was doubly impressed. One, that this polymath, whom I read in commentary, pursued his sources so scrupulously, and B, that my colleague was the person whom he was consulting. But by then I had been reading Himmelfarb for more than a decade, and I hadn't thought about the difference between an intellectual who looks for information to support his ideas and a scholar who wants to know everything that there is to know about a subject. So Himmelfarb was the rarest combination of both, the learned Jew, who's also a modern American intellectual. Had he been a generation younger, that is, someone closer to Blitzstein's age and mine, he too might have entered the academy to teach rather than write as he did about the Jews. And from my perspective, that would have been a major loss. Of all those who wrote for commentary, Himmelfarb is actually the one from whom I learned the most. His essays relied heavily on quotations, examples, historical details, as though part of his purpose was to supply his readers with cultural reinforcement. His references run the gamut in multiple languages, from Rashi and the Latin classics to Leo Strauss and Yellow Submarine, the Beatles movie, which, as his daughter Martha points out, he analyzed in relation to Matthew Arnold's categories of Hebraism and Hellenism. If you've seen the movie, I'm sure this must have occurred to you, right? He noted that yellow was the color of life and joy, the Hellenism in Arnold's terms. The blue meanies say no to everything. Their color represents the Puritanism of Arnold's Hebraism. And as Martha writes, my father pointed to a remarkable line partway through the movie, which says, "That's funny, you don't look bluish," which was the key. And of course, Himmelfarb was on the side of the blue of Hebraism, of saying no, the shalt not. So one of my own favorite moments in a Himmelfarb essay just shows you our predilections, and in my case, perhaps my perversity. This comes in the discussion of a difference between writing for the general public and writing internally. When Jews, he writes, when Jews spoke a language of their own, they could criticize and admonish each other without worrying about giving ammunition to enemies. And to make the point, he cites a saying of the Zionist leader Shmariahu Levin. Das jiddische Volk ist ein klein Volk, aber paskudne, which his friend, the historian Lucy Davidovits, translates as, Jews are a small people, but rotten. You get the idea. This is the kind of wit that delights those of us who spend our lives inside the Jewish community. It's funny because, of course, when you formulate a sentence like, medicine tastes lousy but is good for you, the conjunction but is expected to introduce an extenuating element to offset the original negative feature. And instead of countering the smallness with something like, Jews are a small people, but brilliant. The saying goes in the opposite direction to condemn Jews, but in a way that also appeals, hopefully, to their sense of humor. So this is one of my favorite sayings, but I have found that it does not go over so well with my fellow Jews. In any case, Himmelfarb always spoke as a Jewish insider, even when he was writing for the general public. And this was like a host who welcomes all comers into his home, but doesn't feel the need to rearrange the furniture on their account. This is not my metaphor. Someone's very helpfully provided it, but I think that this is really describes the way he writes. And unfortunately, I think that that habit felt a little bit more comfortable in the 1960s and 70s than it may today. In any case, Milton Himmelfarb was born in 1918 to an immigrant family in Brooklyn, the older brother of Gertrude Himmelfarb, may she have long years, which later made him the brother-in-law of Irving Kristol. Like a number of New York intellectuals we've been discussing in these talks, he attended City College in the 1930s, 2 years ahead of Kristol, with little time for radical politics, since he simultaneously attended the Jewish Theological Seminary. In 1942, Himmelfarb began working in the research division of the American Jewish Committee, and in time he became director of research and editor of the American Jewish Yearbook. The yearbook's mandate was to gather statistics and information about American Jewish life, including culture, politics, religion, as well as demography and sociology, so that he had all this material at his fingertips. And he was also charged with researching and commissioning articles for the yearbook on the condition of Jews in Israel and elsewhere, which placed him intellectually at the heart of the Jewish people worldwide. Now, in countries where Jews are free to compete at the higher levels of culture, they almost always become prominent if they downplay rather than highlight their Jewishness. And this was what happened among most of the New York intellectuals who benefited from the liberal post-war atmosphere to become American critics, writers, professors, editors, and spokespersons. Milton's sister, Gertrude, became a distinguished historian specializing in British intellectual history, and he, Milton, is usually referred to as her brother, not the other way around. Yet the American Jewish Committee afforded Milton Himmelfarb the chance to remain a professional Jewish thinker before there were Jewish studies in the universities. And when the AJC established Commentary in 1945 as a general magazine under Jewish auspices, he acquired an outlet for his ideas. Milton became the go-to intellectual for Jewish matters, but as a result, he was not included among the other New York intellectuals. The most Catholic among them, in his reading and exploration, he was unjustly considered parochial because he wrote mostly on Jewish matters. So let's start with politics. Just as Irving Kristol is associated with his definition of a neoconservative as a liberal who has been mugged by reality, Himmelfarb is known for what David Singer, who took over for him at the American Jewish Committee, calls the iron law of Jewish political behavior. Jews, this is it, Jews earn like Episcopalians, but vote like Puerto Ricans. Both formulations address the same phenomenon of citizens who fail to realize where their political interests really lie. Himmelfarb's Jews are obviously a subset of Kristol's liberals, with this difference, that the Jewish version of the axiom was much more acute and more enduring. In fact, writing in 1985, 2 decades after issuing this iron law of Jewish political behavior, Himmelfarb rephrased the last part of it to read, Jews earn like Episcopalians and vote like Hispanics, only more so. Right? Democracies expect people to vote in their enlightened self-interest. So why don't the Jews? Milton Himmelfarb was the first to probe this question that we have been asking ever since, the question that Norman Podhoretz, for example, poses and tries to answer in his most recent book, Why Are Jews Liberal? I think that Milton Himmelfarb remains the enduring authority on this subject. Now, he didn't become an authority overnight. His ideas crystallized in a series of critical book reviews at the start of his career. So in 1948, the year of Israel's founding, Himmelfarb reviewed My Glorious Brothers, the historical novel about the Maccabees by the communist writer Howard Fast. Fast had been a Communist Party member since 1934, and he was among those who were charged with conspiracy by the House Committee on Un-American Activities. The novel was ostensibly in praise of Israel's War of Independence, and the advertisements read, "This is the story of the Maccabees, five glorious brothers who lead the rebellion by the Jewish people of Judea against the cruel tyranny of that land's Greek and Syrian occupiers." Now, with this book, then, Fast was staking a claim as the new champion of the Jews. Or rather, that is what he pretended to be doing, because there was certainly no question of how the Communist Party understood My Glorious Brothers. One of its chief spokesmen, Morris Chappes, called writing the novel, quote, an act of defiance. He writes, this is Chappes's understanding of the book. The book was composed during the year in which Howard Fast was in the front line of a battle against the tyranny of the House Committee of Un-American Activities. He had been unbendingly obedient to the law of the class struggle, never to surrender names to the enemy. The process of completing the volume was in part a race against time when he would be compelled to serve a prison sentence for his stand. Since the publication date, finds Fast still on bail. I commend the book to the attention of the judges of the Supreme Court, which is now deciding whether to review the case. Four, My Glorious Brothers deals with obedience to law. Resistance to tyrants, we learn from this retelling of the heroism of the Maccabees, is the truest obedience to law. The writing of it must have been an intensification of Fast's still incompleted experience of resistance to the American fascists. In forging his Maccabees, Fast hammered steel for his own use. His own conduct in battle steadied the flame with which the Maccabees burn. You see, this is pretty unambiguous as far as the party was concerned. To Chappes, the book's only flaw is one of the unfortunate nationalist elements, and that is the emphasis on Jewish pride. That's the flaw of the book as far as the party was concerned. And it was just considered a valuable weapon in the Stalinist battle for the heart of America. So though many readers then and since have blindly accepted Howard Fast's version of the Maccabean story, Himmelfarb does not let him get away with this perversion of history, theology, or national integrity. He writes, on the surface, the book is a tract to arouse admiration for a great national resistance to a foreign oppressor intent on wiping out the national culture. But its real purpose is to make this respectable sentiment a vehicle of propaganda against American policy toward the Soviet Union. He shows how Fast makes the sinister Roman legate a representative of American free enterprise, who is trying to crush the Soviet-style Maccabee revolutionaries, and how the vicious and violent aspects of Stalinism come through in this book's love of bloodshed. Himmelfarb writes, there are few chapters in My Glorious Brothers that do not show the Maccabees wading knee-deep in the blood of 5,000 more Seleucid mercenaries. Alexander Nevsky hath slain his thousands, and Howard Fast his 10,000s. This is so brilliant. Nevsky was the title figure in a famous film by Sergei Eisenstein that conscripted the medieval Russian tyrant to justify Stalinist terror. Himmelfarb cleverly connects what Fast is doing in this novel with the Soviet glorification of the Soviet Great Terror, the purge of communist ranks that killed off an estimated 1 million Russians between 1936 and 1938. So communists won over many Jews in the 1930s in particular by pretending to be on their side while actually destroying and denigrating everything that Judaism stood for. Himmelfarb unmasked their manipulation and showed how American communists, and Jews emphatically included among them, aided and abetted Stalin's crimes. Now, in Himmelfarb's estimation, even more damaging to the Jews than this communist propaganda, more damaging at least spiritually and morally, was the legacy of the German Reform Movement that claimed to be the true essence of Judaism. Traditional Judaism maintains an indissoluble combination of particularism and universalism. Communism dumped religion, but the Reform Movement threw out the indispensable national component of Judaism. Himmelfarb writes, what is that? The national component, right? He writes as follows. When a complex unity breaks down, its previously unified elements, taking on an independent life of their own, are often perceived as being in conflict. So, with universalism and particularism in Jewish religion after emancipation, classical reform accepted the first and rejected the second with equal ardor. Now, this remained a cornerstone of Himmelfarb's thinking. The contractual relationship of the Jewish people with God allows and encourages them to live confidently among the nations. The German Reform Movement thought it had to give up the tribal particularism of Judaism in order to be worldly. But Himmelfarb finds that the universalists, whether German or later American, are simply adopting the values and prejudices of the surrounding society, or to be more precise, of that sector of society that they most admire and aspire to belong to. And he finds this very ironic. He says, whereas Jews are taught by the Bible and Talmud, and Christians by Jesus and St. Paul, that Jewish particularism is divinely ordained, neither Jews nor Christians can find any warrant for making that claim for American or other modern national particularism. Our universalists, therefore, tend to substitute for a particularism sanctified by the tradition a pseudo-universalism concealing a particularism that is untraditional and idolatrous. In every case, he shows, and he brings in the course of his essays quite a number, when modern Jews compare Judaism unfavorably with something that was presumably more worldly, he shows that they were lifting their ideas of universalism from the surrounding culture and its own very particular disposition. Now, he was as much a comparatist as any of the writers he reviewed, but his starting point was always Judaism. He does not find any way of life better than that of the Jews. Now, Himmelfarb's special antipathy during his first decade as a writer was directed at the American Council for Judaism, which split off from the rest of the American Reform Movement in 1942 to become an outright anti-Zionist organization and was still going strong after the birth of Israel. The council declared that Judaism was an exclusively a religion, and it opposed Zionism outright, especially its call for an independent Jewish army. In 1952, its leader, Rabbi Elmer Berger, published a partisan history of Judaism, charging that secular Jewish nationalism, and particularly Zionism, was exploiting, corrupting, and undermining Jewish religion, and calling for a return to the ideals of the ancient prophets and leaders of 19th century reform. Now, Himmelfarb at this point can scarcely control his anger. He quotes Santayana, Fanaticism consists of redoubling your efforts when you have forgotten your aim. The anti-Zionism of the German Reform Movement may have been understandable, he writes, in the 19th century context, but with the rise of Nazi Germany, the American Reform Movement had the wisdom to modify its earlier anti-Zionism. For Rabbi Berger, to reject Jewish particularism after the creation of Israel was a fanatical denial of reality, and with fanaticism comes contempt for the truth. Pretending to speak in the name of the Hebrew prophets, Berger presents the teaching of Amos in the single verse, "Are ye not as the children of the Ethiopians unto me, O children of Israel?" In other words, God as the great universalist. But there are still some of us, says Himmelfarb, who know the whole book of Amos, including such verses as this, "You only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will visit upon you all your iniquities." He quotes Reinhold Niebuhr on how the tension between these two verses actually illustrates the complex relation between God and Israel. Niebuhr understands the God of Israel is both universal and in a particular relationship with the Jews who are bound by his Torah. The Christian theologian has a much deeper and more honest appreciation of Judaism than this mendacious Jewish reformer. So Himmelfarb demonstrates, this is that to stand for Judaism and the Jews, you have to be prepared to stand against their replacements. One by one, he took down all the forces hostile to Jewishness in America that threatened the safety of the Jewish people in its newly recovered homeland, and tried to destroy Judaism's indissoluble fusion of religion and nationhood, which is the basis of a covenantal people. So he is a fighter, I find, like no other in this respect, really seeing where the enemies lie. And if you've ever tried to do this, you understand how difficult it is to take a carefully constructed argument of someone who wants to tear down one aspect of the Jewish people or all aspects of the Jewish people, and really to slice them apart and leave only your own argument and your own conviction solid. So this habit of fending off attack made Himmelfarb the first to identify and concentrate on the liberal threat to American Jewry. Whereas European Jews had often converted to Christianity for the sake of convenience, in America there was no need to convert, for one did not have to stay bound to either religion or ethnicity. Jews were now free to be you and me. They could simply blend into the surrounding population. But if not into Christians, then into what? There was no such thing as having no identity. People born to Jews and still content to call themselves Jews began replacing Judaism with the lifestyle that they found most attractive or convenient. As the ideological underpinnings of communism and Reform Judaism fell away, there emerged in their stead an amorphous liberalism that expressed itself in unwavering political loyalty to the Democratic Party and ethnic attachment to Jewish food. Himmelfarb honed in on why it was bad for the Jews and for America. Why bad and how bad? Well, at the most basic level, he worried about the shrinking numbers of an already decimated people. He asked, why so many American proponents of zero population growth were Jews, whereas the birth rate in Jewish DP camps after the war was 75 to 100 for every 1,000. The data were always before him. In September 1961, he warned of the low Jewish birth rate. 2 years later, he described the vanishing Jew as the consequence of a free society, and taunted the rabbis for failing to encourage conversion. The synagogue service, he writes, ends with the Aleinu prayer that concludes with the ringing verse from Zechariah. V'haya Adonai l'melech al kol ha'aretz b'yom ha'hu yeh Adonai echad u'shmo echad. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall the Lord be one and his name one. Why then don't the rabbis try to bring that day a little closer? They should say to their congregants, it is best not to intermarry, but probably some of you will. If you do, try to persuade your fiancé to become a Jew. Why withhold our tradition and religion from someone you want to marry? And extending this idea a little bit further, he extends it to the kinship the Jews say that they feel with Black Americans. He writes, we Jews must surely have some regard for our religion and tradition, enough at any rate to prefer them to Christianity, since we continue to call ourselves Jews. In the United States, if we wanted to, we could probably welcome a fair number of African Americans into our midst. He says Negroes in the usage of 1964. By putting our rhetoric to the test, it would make us try to turn moralizing into morality. We would not succeed brilliantly, but at least we would be doing something serious. Our failure to invite others into our ranks shows our lack of intellectual as well as moral self-confidence and the unhealthy part of our insularity, since if we truly respected our fellow citizens, we would invite them to become Jews like us. A Jew ought to assume that would be good for them and especially good for us. Arguments like these, I think, confirm that Himmelfarb was concerned not just about the body count of Jews in America, he and his wife had seven children, but about the failure of Jewish nerve, the lack of Jewish conviction. In a free society, if you recognize the advantages of Judaism, generosity would prompt you to want to share it with others. The more careless and indifferent American Jews became about their Jewishness through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, the blunter and I would say angrier he grew about the waste and misdirected energy. Of course, being the intellectual he was, he also saw another and contrasting problem, the problem of our fundamentalists, who totally oppose everything that does not totally oppose what is not totally orthodox. He frames this hyper-orthodoxy in these wholly negative terms. And in fact, maybe we'll have a chance to, in the discussion afterwards to see how progressive he really was on certain matters governing Jewish practice. But, and this is part of Himmelfarb's thinking that I particularly appreciate, he follows up his criticism of Jewish fundamentalism with this distinction. This is a very difficult pact. I'll try to unpack this sentence. Though he would have joined the Enlighteners against Hatam Sofer's extreme kind of orthodoxy, he notes that whereas the Cheka recited Hebrew poetry and killed people in prison cellars, and some of Heine's Aryan descendants may have been Nazis, that cannot be said of the followers of Samson Raphael Hirsch. This sends us scurrying after all these references. And by the way, a Himmelfarb essay will send you, I mean, now thank God we have something like Google, because there were not reference books enough to find all the references of a Himmelfarb essay. But so the Chatam Sofer was the 18th century German rabbi who fought off the attempts of secularists to modernize the community. The Cheka was the enforcing arm of the Bolshevik Revolution that included many Jews who executed anyone they deemed to be an enemy of the revolution. Heinrich Heine was the great German Jewish writer who converted to Christianity. He had no children, so this must refer to his literary heirs, some of whom did become Nazis. And Samson Raphael Hirsch was the mighty leader of German Orthodoxy in the 19th century, whose watchword was Torah and secular culture. So if the medium is the message, Himmelfarb has just given us a crash course on the cultural history of modernity. But we probably could have understood his meaning even without catching all the details. Yes, we would like to see Jewish Orthodoxy turning less defensive than it is and more responsive to certain liberalizing trends. But if the alternatives are ultra-Orthodox Jews versus modern Jews who joined the totalitarian brutes, one can say that Judaism at its most extreme is always more trustworthy than its alternatives. Judaism is relatively better than all other ways of life, and in an evil world, that should be enough to make us stick with it. Himmelfarb wants modern Jews to stand firm in their Judaism, which, according to his analysis, they never learned to do with enough intelligence and conviction. He laments the failure of American Jews in particular to live up to their noble assignment in the history of civilization. He thinks that liberal Jews have moved in the wrong direction, and instead of using American freedom to strengthen what is best in religious civilization, they have drifted into the opposite of Judaism, which is harmful to them and to America. The trouble, he writes, the trouble is not that religion in general has too small a role in American public life or American life simply. The trouble is that a particular religion has too great a role. Paganism, the de facto established religion, and Judaism is against paganism, and yet many Jews have chosen paganism. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, he has an essay devoted to paganism, and it cannot really be summarized in a soundbite, but he writes, "Paganism, idolatry, unchastity, licentiousness, and murder, bloodshed, are for Judaism the unholy triad." And he shows to what extent we moderns have idolized paganism. Godless self-indulgence has led to release from restraint rather than the practice of restraint. The promotion of sex and drugs and preference for the body of youth over the wisdom of elders. The Declaration of Independence upholds the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But, he writes, some of what began as liberal has become libertine, and libertinism has brought enslavement and misery more than it has brought liberation and happiness. AIDS, kids who have kids, the vanishing father. First, the French Revolution devoured its children, then the Bolshevik Revolution, and now the sexual revolution. So given this collapse of civilizing values, it's no wonder that Himmelfarb finds much greater affinity with Christians than he does with liberals. He writes, "The liberals offer me friendship because I am a man, but they slight my tradition and memories. The neo-Orthodox, today he would have said the evangelicals, offer me friendship because God is my father and the father of all men, and they also honor my tradition." So if most Jews nevertheless prefer the liberals, as he believes they do, they will not sustain their Jewishness or protect it politically. Christianity joins the Jews in rejecting paganism, and that makes us allies in the American context. At every step of his thinking, he acknowledges the attractions of modernity, but then he shows how the Western religious tradition is the necessary safeguard of that civilization. So the intellectuals that I've been discussing in this series, Lionel Trilling, Robert Warshaw, Leslie Fiedler, Irving Kristol, Norman Podhoretz, and Midge Dechter, were all troubled by certain aspects of liberalism, such as its susceptibility to radical and totalitarian temptations, its inadequate response to evil and violence, and its essential limitations in upholding the Western civilization of which it forms an important part. Whenever a democracy slips too far to this liberal side, it is in danger of surrendering its principles and losing its life. Having seen their own moral and intellectual balance tip dangerously to the radical side, all those thinkers that I mentioned struggle to recover the national equilibrium which required a shift to some form of conservatism. Well, Himmelfarb differed. In having always lived as a Jew, a Jewish father, a Jewish thinker, a practicing Jewish American. Whereas his brother-in-law, Irving Kristol, came around to recognizing the importance of religion, Himmelfarb knew it from the start and could therefore describe how the American Constitution's nuanced conception of the separation of church and state was being turned by doctrinal liberal secularists into a war on religion. Liberal Jews were probably more devoted than anyone else in America to the separation of church and state, their experience as a people having led them to believe that, quote, religious freedom is most secure where church and state are separated and least secure where church and state are united. But then he painstakingly demonstrates this rule of thumb simply does not apply. Where do you put England, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden with their state churches? No Jew can deny that those countries are, as we used to say, good for the Jews. And conversely, in a strictly secular society like the Soviet Union, the strictest separationism led to the persecution of religion. The radical separationists among the Jews are prepared to sacrifice the real advantages of government funding for Catholic schooling that benefits inner city children. They are prepared to sacrifice justifiable government subvention of general education in Jewish schools. They oppose prayer, the invocation of God, public display of the Ten Commandments, all in the name of what they foolishly or wickedly take to be the higher ideal of a liberal society. They are like Samson bringing down the temple, not the temple of the Philistines, but the world's most powerful democracy that was decent to the Jews and its citizenry only because it considers itself under the aegis of God. What Himmelfarb probes, in effect, is the way a huge segment of American Jewry is not liberal or secular in this older sense of simply abstaining from religious practice, but now fiercely loyal to an alternative separationism, that is, to something opposed to the religious tradition and to the intricate essence of Judaism in particular. He writes, the First Amendment does not command, quote, thou shalt not give governmental aid to parochial schools. It commands that there shall be no establishment of religion and no curtailment of the free exercise of religion. The rabbi said that the gates of interpretation of the Torah are not closed, and the Supreme Court has shown that neither are the gates of the interpretation of the Constitution closed. Already in 1966, he recognized that if Jews and Catholics do not obtain governmental support for the education of their children, they will not become better Americans, but lesser Jews, and therefore lesser Americans, since their religious education and way of life contributed rather than detracted from their civic responsibilities. And this is true, he shows, for both Jews and Catholics. He sensed and then demonstrated that separationism was actually directed against the observance of Judaism. So, that Jews do not vote for Jewish interests, that they do not instinctively, energetically safeguard Israel's international rights and reputation, that they live not according to the teachings of Judaism, but against all that Judaism stands for, means that they constitute an opposing system of belief. The danger is not that there are fewer Jews, but that there are Jewish anti-Jews who have not yet settled on a new name for their persuasion. Himmelfarb does not put it quite that starkly, but then he stopped writing in the 1990s. Just as his later thinking was already present in his writings of the 1940s, we have little difficulty applying his insights into our current situation. In his last contribution to commentary, he wrote, "What is our distinctive mission today? As always, to remain in being as Jews." Asked to consider whether there would be a large-scale revival of Judaism in America, he quotes God's question to Abraham in Genesis chapter 18. Is anything too hard for the Lord? And this is Himmelfarb's follow-up to that. More probably, there will be, to echo Ninochka's sinister justification of Stalin's purges in the film Ninochka, there will be fewer but better Russians. And he says, there will be fewer but better Jews. On the demographic side, they will intermarry less than we do now and may procreate more. This is just one of the many ways in which his insight seems to have been foresight. There will be fewer but better Russians, fewer but better Jews. Is it not so? Thankfully, Himmelfarb leaves us a roadmap, and we can follow the train of his ideas on our own. So, a great thinker. Thank you. Ozick has invented a new form of fiction that follows from traditional halacha and agada by combining the two, by combining the natural with the supernatural, or storytelling with moral reasoning.